I'd like you to join me in welcoming Director Rodriguez here today.
Thank you. Thank you. So I'd like to begin this morning, can everybody hear me okay, with a little bit of a confession. How many of you here are Georgetown Law students? Actually, nobody. There's a couple. There we go. There we go in the back. So you will appreciate the following anecdote. I have, this is actually my second opportunity to speak in this room in the last few years. Prior to that, the last time I was in this building was roughly 28 years ago when I was waitlisted at Georgetown University Law Center, and I came here to meet the Dean of Admissions and to try to persuade him to actually let me in. And he looked at my undergraduate transcript, he looked at the rest of my file, and he said, it's actually a miracle that you're even on the wait list, so forget about actually getting admitted. And I really wanted to tell this story because, you know, here I am sort of back as the director of a federal agency, so I really wanted to tell this story. And so I was thinking to myself, what's the relevance of this story? Why does it matter to the discussion that we're going to be having this morning and the discussion that you're going to be having? And I realized that it actually is a great metaphor for immigration. Because what we do in immigration policy is decide who we want to admit to the United States and who we don't. And it's based on a whole set of factors that I want to talk about a little bit this morning. But the basic idea is that we're predicting that this individual who we admit to the United States will be good for America. That in some way they will promote our values, they will promote our objectives. So I now pose the rhetorical question, looking back, Georgetown, would you have admitted me had you known this information? Would you have had different policies if you would have known what the outcome was? I really just wanted to tell you that story. So let me, as I launch into the substance of my speech, first of all, thank the Center for Migration Studies, the Migration Policy Institute, clinic in Georgetown itself for putting together and hosting this conference. This conference has now been going on for more than a decade, as Professor Schoenholtz noted, to the initial shock of Dean Aleinikoff, and has really become one of the key fora for discussion and exchange on immigration policy. So I really thank you all for creating this sort of forum for us. I also want to recognize Doris Meissner, who was the Director of Immigration and Naturalization Services back during the Clinton administration, is now with the Migration Policy Institute. If you come to my agency, and I know we have a couple of examples here with Phyllis Coben and Chris Bentley. Phyllis Coben is our New York director of our New York field office. Chris Bentley is our press secretary. One thing that people speak of with pride is that they are, quote, legacy INS, that they were in the agency back in the INS days. And I think that really owes in great part to the kind of leadership that you provided during those years. And we not only have federal officials or former federal officials who are part of this dialogue, we have here today Nisha Agarwal, from the New York City Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs. We've engaged with Ambassador Altschul from El Salvador. They just opened a consulate in McAllen, Texas. So it really gives you a flavor for the broad spectrum of individuals, of organizations that really play a role in this really critical, critical issue. I have three personal experiences that really inform my vision of being the director of USCIS. First of all, you heard as part of my bio that I'm the son of Cuban immigrants, the grandson of immigrants from Turkey and Poland to Cuba who were fleeing anti-Semitism. And certainly because of those experiences, I understand the aspect of immigration that is based on seeking refuge, fleeing a situation that has become in some way no longer tolerable, and coming to where the situation can be better. And the Miami that I grew up, although I was born in Brooklyn, I actually grew up in Miami. The Miami of my childhood really provides a case study, not just in what it means to be seeking refuge, but also in then what immigrants do for America. This point that I was talking about, immigrants are good for America. And the Miami of my childhood was really this amazing cauldron of energy. It wasn't just people from Cuba, where my parents were from, but people from all over, Jewish immigrants or children of Jewish immigrants, from Eastern Europe, people from all over the Caribbean. And what it made even then, and it's only continued until now, Miami, with all its chaos, with all its craziness, was also one of the most economically vibrant cities in the United States. So I'm actually a real believer in the notion that immigrants are really what energize our economy, what actually make us the kind of powerful economy that we are. And it's not just the software engineers, although we love them and we want as many of them as we can get, but it's also it's the guys that laid our railroad tracks. It's the welders. It's the agricultural workers. It's really a broad spectrum of individuals who really have immigrated and then really energized our economy. There's a second experience that informs my work as well. As a law student at Boston College Law School, I was the coordinator of something called the Holocaust Human Rights Research Project. And what we did in this project was to analyze the precedents of Nazi war crimes law, litigation, to other situations of human rights abuse. And a big part of the discussion that we would have about Nazi war criminals was the role of the immigration process here in the United States. And the denaturalization and deportation proceedings of those individuals. And they were really a very early lesson before we were really talking about September 11th and talking about all these examples of terrorists abusing our immigration system, of the fact that our immigration system could be abused by bad people. By people who in this case had engaged in harm in the past or, as we have learned all too tragically, individuals who could abuse our immigration system to come and in some way harm the American people. And that it means that as we offer refuge, as we look to energize our economy, we always have to worry about the fact that there are people who can abuse our immigration system and come to do us harm. And there is a third experience, in fact, that Professor Schoenholtz underscored. And that is comes from my prosecution of human trafficking. And through the Flores case, I spent a lot of time with a number of individuals who originally came here undocumented from Guatemala and Mexico to work in the tomato and cucumber fields of South Carolina and also the citrus groves in Florida. And as people talk about individuals like the victims in this case, there are two dominant narratives. And I want to offer a third one about those individuals. The first narrative is what I would call the law enforcement bureaucratic narrative. These are individuals who've broken the law, and they have. They have come to the United States illegally. We have a responsibility to enforce that law. There is a second narrative, which is a social justice narrative, which is also really important, and that is that these individuals have fled circumstances in the countries from which they come that are intolerable both politically and economically, and frequently saw themselves as having no choice but to come here to the United States, where many would argue they continue in many respects to be victims, where they are abused by abusive employers, where because of their undocumented status, they live in the shadows. Again, all things that are true. But as I got to know these individuals, I saw a third thing. I actually saw potential Americans, because these individuals had two core values in their life that seemed very, very familiar to me. The first was work. Typically, these individuals would be engaged in back-breaking labor for 14 hours a day, day after day. And the second was family, because the beneficiaries of that labor were typically their families back in Guatemala and Mexico. And so as I met them, they did not impress me as victims particularly. They impressed me as people just like my parents, whose lives were really built around the same exact values as those of my parents. So as I lead the agency that is responsible for adjudicating immigration benefits as they play a role and give my voice to the development of immigration policy, these three experiences are frequently ones that I see in my mind as we engage in this discussion. At USCIS, we touch just about every aspect of American life, marriage, work, education, public safety, national security, as I underscored before. The environment in which we work is constantly shifting. It's also growing. We're at 18,500 professionals now in 250 locations worldwide. Most of those here in the United States, but many of those abroad. And really, I have to say, having now been in the agency for about 100 days, a really fantastic, passionate, very professional group of workers, people that we really can be proud of as Americans. And I view my role as to ensure that we apply the laws fairly, that we do our work professionally, that my folks have what they need to do their job well, but at the same time that we do it with a sense of justice and a sense of customer service. You heard that I used to work for Montgomery County, and I was actually the county attorney in Montgomery County, more or less the general counsel for Montgomery County. And before I came to that job, really my entire profession had really been in some version of the criminal justice arena. I had been a prosecutor, I'd been a white-collar defense lawyer, and so now the largest part of my job was actually land use, was zoning. And I will tell you that I loved zoning. I thought zoning was extremely interesting, and people laugh. I heard a couple chuckles out there. And in fact, when I interviewed with Janet Napolitano, then Secretary Napolitano, for this job, I said, I can make you love zoning. I think I can make it extremely interesting to you. And she looked at me, of course, like I was crazy. But here is the reason. And there's an analog to immigration here that I want to share. Zoning, when you think about it, implicates every single value that we have as a society. Zoning requires us to think about economics, how we want to develop our local economies. It requires us to think about economic justice. Do we want to have zoning that provides opportunities to low and middle income people? It's about the environment. We have to think about how the zoning affects the environment in which people are going to live. It requires us to think about how we want to talk about families. One of the big debates that we would be having in Montgomery County was how many people could live in a dwelling, because most of us in the county had the sort of traditional suburban view there should be a mom, dad, and two kids in the household, except a lot of our households in Montgomery County weren't looking exactly like that anymore, and there could be an uncle and there could be a grandparent who would come from another country in the household. So it required us to think about everything we value, everything we think about ourselves as a society. And I would suggest immigration is exactly the same way. And the reason there's so much to talk about immigration, the reason we have such an intense debate about immigration, although I would suggest there is more consensus than people think about immigration, is exactly because just about everything that people think and feel about our civic society is implicated in immigration. So it begins with humanitarian notions. To whom do we want to provide refuge? That's the first. That is a core American value that we provide refuge. The challenge comes that we don't necessarily agree on refuge from what. And so typically the sort of vision of what we are providing refuge from is refuge from torture. Good old-fashioned government-sponsored in-jail torture. That's something that everybody can visualize, everybody agrees upon. We all agree that we should provide refuge from that. But then it starts getting a little more complicated than that. How about intolerable economic conditions? Conditions that none of us would ever tolerate for our own children. Should we provide refuge from that? Then the debate gets more intense. How about situations where what the government has done is failed? What the government has done is fail to protect its people from the kind of harms where we here in the United States would ordinarily expect that our government would protect us. Is that a situation from which we provide refuge? So that's one value. Another is economic development. The one thing that I think most Americans agree upon is we want a vibrant economy. Everybody agrees that the more vibrant economy, the more everybody benefits. The problem is we don't necessarily agree on what fuels a vibrant economy. Right now, as we picture, and you certainly, if you talk to university presidents, they rightfully so say, the one thing we definitely don't want to be doing is educating people in our universities and then having them go back where they came from and not benefiting our economy. So we agree that people with a high level of technical expertise benefit our economy. But how about small business people? How about going out to Bladensburg, Maryland, where if you drive down Kenilworth Avenue, you will see this amazing level of economic vibrancy, restaurants, shops. We don't have, that I'm aware of, a specific visa category for small business people. Yet what has energized Bladensburg, Maryland, is all of these small businesses. Another issue. Family, obviously, another big thing we look at. Educational, national security. All of these are different values that we hold dear, but which we all look at differently, that really all go into our immigration policy. And so when we talk about what it means to be a nation of immigrants, we realize that what that means is actually in the eye of the beholder. But we do know one thing. Actually, one of my favorite documents that I got to look at during the confirmation process was the annual statistical tables from the Bureau of Immigration Statistics. Fascinating document. Because one of the things that you learn is that, in fact, most migration actually occurs in the southern hemisphere. So while we picture that the sort of primary vector of migration is people really moving east to west, either coming here to the United States or to Western Europe, in fact, most migration is sort of people moving around in the southern hemisphere of the world. But still, with that, the single place per capita to which most people migrate is the United States, legally and illegally, is the United States. And so we ask ourselves, why is that? And that really goes to, you know, sort of this fundamental question. There's nothing like America. There's nothing like the energy. There's nothing like the values of America. I think my time is going faster than I thought it would. So I want to get to a couple things. I want to talk about deferred action for childhood arrivals. I had an experience shortly after I got here where I was introduced to 20 kids, all of them from Los Angeles. They were all students, and they were all DACA recipients. Many of them, classic case, were DACA recipients who spent a great part of their life not knowing that they were in the United States illegally. They actually assumed that they were here illegally. They came here that young. This was an amazing group of young people. There was a young woman who was getting ready to graduate from Harvard. There was another young woman who had started medical school and, in fact, was trying to decide what field she should go into. She was considering becoming an obstetrician-gynecologist. I'm married to an obstetrician-gynecologist who has frequently said, you actually should go into dermatology. So I shared that advice with her that my wife would tell her you should go into dermatology. But one of the things that occurred to me is that amazing as these young people were, and query if there is not a fundamental problem in the structure of immigration system, if there is not a path for this society to take advantage of what these young people have to offer. But they're not the only part of the DACA picture. Because for as many kids like that as there are kids willing to break their back and work hard in a number of fields. Kids who want to be really good plumbers, really entrepreneurial plumbers, opening businesses, restaurateurs, shop owners. All of those really represent a potential to energize their economy. But what that experience really reaffirmed for me is that we have to approach immigration in a way that gives individuals like this a chance. The president has made clear that in the absence, in the wake of the failure of Congress to really give him a credible, comprehensive immigration reform package, that he will act on his own sometime between the election and the end of the year. And I assume everybody is here ready for me to tell them the details of that program, right? Okay. What I will tell you is this. We're going to be ready. Our agency will be shouldering the primary responsibility for executing whatever it is that the president and then in turn Secretary Johnson orders. And we have been busy making sure that however this is done, we do it in a way that actually works. And so that's the one commitment that I can make to you. The other thing that I would point out is that as we think about a broken immigration system and as we think about the failure to actually pass a comprehensive immigration reform, it's important to always remember that this discussion is about much more than individuals who are in the United States in an undocumented status. So not only is it a symptom of a broken immigration system that we have 11 million people in the United States in an undocumented status. Many of them, by the way, I know we have Migration Policy Institute has done a lot of work on this. Many of them now in the United States for a long time. I know we're talking a lot about what's going on the southern border right now, but many of these folks, in fact, have been here for 10-plus years, 15-plus years, 25-plus years. They are now part of our society, whether it is that is recognized or not. They are now part of our society. So that's one issue. But that's not the only issue. The fact that we have a basic immigration structure that is out of line with the needs of our economy is another issue. The fact that very often your access to different kinds of immigration benefits can take years and decades is another symptom of a broken system. And a lot of people talk about this notion of waiting in line. There are a lot of places where there is no line. There is no line, depending on who you are and where you're from and what you do and what your economic status. there is no line. So all of that, all of those kinds of questions are part of the symptom of a broken immigration system. I also want to talk for just a second about the situation that we have on our border. And I want to talk about it as a situation on our border as opposed to the situation of the UACs, who are part of it, but they're not all of it. And this is something not well understood by the general public. The general public has really focused on this notion of children who they'd like to not admit are children coming to the United States and then sort of finding some path to staying here. In fact, the migration is migration of people of all ages. There are kids coming over, there are families coming over, there are adults coming over. And our agency plays a significant role in all of these scenarios. More and more, the adults coming over are making different kinds of claims of persecution. And we have done what we needed to do in order to provide these individuals with credible fear screenings at the border. And more kids are also, once they're settled here, either in foster families or otherwise through the auspices of HHS, presenting asylum claims of different kinds. And the complaint is that both the credible fear allegations and the asylum claims are somehow fabricated, or that somehow we are recognizing these claims where we should not. And the one assurance that I want to provide in this area is that we are doing our job. One of the first things that I did when I became director was to sit in on an asylum interview. And I came to my observation in this interview with the eyes of a former prosecutor. I have made people confess. And so I was able to watch the quality of this interview. And I was really struck by two aspects of this interview. One, it was a thorough interview. And everywhere where I thought the young man who was conducting the interview should have followed up, he followed up. He asked those second and third questions to really probe the validity of the claim being made. But at the same time, it is part of our responsibility to make sure that these individuals are afforded due process. And we will uphold that that responsibility. Because as much as anything else, given our history, where I started this conversation, as a country that offers refuge, the one thing that would certainly be a tragedy is to not provide due process and then to find that somebody who really should have been afforded asylum was not provided asylum. So we're going to continue doing our job. We're going to ask those hard questions. We're going to do good interviews. We're going to deploy so that this process can go on as efficiently as possible. But we're really going to safeguard due process at the same time. I'm really excited about the conference that you guys are going to be having here this morning. I unfortunately will not be able to be here for all of it, but I'm really excited to hear the readout because there's so many of you who have been working for so long and so hard in this field that I think a lot of really, really important insights are going to flow from this. So I'm really looking forward to hearing the readout and also really getting to know and work with many of you in the months and years to come. So with that, I think I'm going to open it up to questions. And I believe the, yeah, there we go.
Yeah, if you could introduce yourselves first and just line up at the mics here.
Hi, my name is Penny Starr. I'm with CNS News. I know that you've mentioned there are people that are coming across the borders, not just from Central and South America, but indeed all over the world. And I wonder if you would address, please, what health screenings, how are they a part of how people are interviewed and checked? You know, where does health come in the screening process for people, especially given Ebola now?
Yeah, understand I'm a little bit outside of my portfolio here. There are health screenings. That is my understanding. I know, for example, specifically there are screenings for tuberculosis, among other conditions. Beyond that, I think actually that would be a great question to direct to HHS, who actually conduct the screenings.
Yes, Director Rodriguez, it's Julia Preston from the New York Times. I'm wondering if you could give us more detailed information about how you're getting ready for the President's executive action. How many people are you anticipating? What are you doing in terms of hiring in a situation where, as you, I'm sure, are aware, you have a fee-based agency, and therefore, to a certain extent, your hiring is based on the applications that are coming in? Just what is the dimension of the program that you are anticipating?
Those are great questions. And what I can tell you right now is that we're doing our job.
I tried.
I'll let the editors know.
Hi. Director Steve Tabachman from Global Detroit. I'm wondering if you can talk as we, you know, hopefully move forward, whether it be through these rules or maybe one day, someday, congressional action. And we reform our immigration system to be one that is more forward-looking, more along the lines of what you talked about, what it brings value to our country and to our economy. How do you plan to use local government in the integration process? You know, a lot of us who deal after the federal issue is adjudicated or not in the case of 11 million unauthorized immigrants, a lot of these issues play out in the local level with schools, with municipal government, with local economies. Have you thought much about how to include local perspectives in the integration process?
No, that's a great question, and thank you for it. It actually gives me an opportunity to underscore something that I should have underscored in my remarks. There is no substitute for actual legislated comprehensive immigration reform. So whatever it is that we may do, whatever it is the president, and the president himself has said this, may direct us to do, that will not anywhere near what we could accomplish with actual legislative reform. The potential of local governments to play a positive role in this space is immense. As it stands, even now, we collaborate extensively with local governments throughout the United States in promoting access to citizenship. One of my favorite aspects of my job is going to naturalization ceremonies and seeing folks become new Americans. That really, the kind of collaborations we've had with different municipal governments, New York City, Los Angeles, are really a model, I think, for some things we could do in other areas as well, or things that we can expand in the future. So there is very definitely a role for that. Yes.
Good morning. Lorela Preli with United We Dream Network. I guess I wanted to understand a little bit more how you're determining who is being placed in detention. When we talk about unaccompanied children and mothers and families, and now we have a mega facility with 2,400 new beds, how are they making a determination about who is placed in detention versus who is sent out to sponsor?
Sure. Again, a question that I would ask you really to direct to Customs and Border Patrol and ICE. And remember, the children, and these unaccompanied children, just to be very clear, they are not permitted under law to be in detention for any sort of extended period of time. There are a number of family units, kids who are here with their parents, who could be in some sort of secure setting. And, of course, adults also are essentially expected to be, unless they're paroled in some way, in a secure setting. But those actual details are not details that we really run from CIS. Those are really ICE and Customs and Border Patrol, Customs and Border Patrol in particular. So I would recommend directing that question to them.
I think we're going to take two more questions here, but I actually wanted to interject one, not to follow up on Julie, but to ask you on implementation, if you can talk about the displacement of other resources, because I know that citizenship is a major priority of yours as well. And if we're talking about a major executive action program covering, you know, millions of people, that obviously takes a lot of resources. It also takes huge amounts of coordination within DHS, with the Department of, the Department of Justice, EOIR, and others. Could you talk a little bit about kind of implementation from that broader perspective?
Sure. And I think one of the really important lessons we learned from DACA, we did experience some impact on our other lines of business. Family visas experienced some longer processing times. Is we really learned how to surge in a way that we really never had before. And so as we prepare for another potential surge, I think we're going to be leaning very heavily on the DOC experience, modeling based on the DOC experience, in order to really minimize impact on the other existing lines of business within CIS. Yep. Sir?
Good morning. Ramon Samko with Johns Hopkins Press. Could you address the claim that children coming from Central American families as well should be considered refugees in a similar way as whole populations moving from one place to another are considered refugees in other parts of the world? And, well, what are the implications of this here in the U.S.?
Sure. No, I mean, I've heard that, and certainly there are situations where we have made positive, credible fear findings, which essentially means that there is a claim for some kind of refuge, and where we are finding that some of the unaccompanied children do appear to qualify for asylum. What I'm really not ready to do, and the record has not sustained this notion, that as an entire class, as a matter of law, okay, there is a sort of a normal understanding of what it means to seek refuge, but that as a matter of law, absolutely every individual crossing the border is a refugee. I'm not prepared to say anything like that. Now, do some of them state very solid claims for asylum status? And the answer, I would say, is very clearly yes.
Hello, my name is Tara Matthews, and I actually work for USCIS. My question is, well, I was interested in what you were saying about matching the immigration system with the economic needs of the country. And I was wondering how you see government working with private sector, academic institutions like this, civil society, to best achieve that goal.
Well, I mean, I think, and I said economics among many factors. I mean, I think, you know, that's why I was making the analogy to zoning, is we look at a variety of different factors. I think private industry plays a very critical role because I think they tell us where the needs are. In fact, that there are, even now, there are particular visa categories that actually require the sponsorship of a company. Or involve the transfer of an individual within a company from one location to another. So the role of the private sector in this dialogue is huge, in fact.
Would you mind one more question?
Yes.
Okay.
No.
You wouldn't mind.
I meant yes, I'll take
you'll take it.
Thank you, I appreciate it. My name is Mona Siddiqui, and I'm a doctoral student at Virginia Commonwealth University. And my question is in regard to the backlog in the affirmative asylum process. And I was just wondering what strategies USCIS is going to be using to address some of these major backlog issues.
Those are great questions because, in fact, the overall asylum caseload has grown dramatically related to the circumstances we're discussing. And in order to process individuals more efficiently at the border, the unaccompanied children presenting claims, we have had to redeploy. We're also hiring more asylum officers in order to meet this additional caseload. We do have a lot of work to catch up, so I don't want to minimize the kind of work that is ahead of us to sort of get up to date with all these processes, but we are moving affirmatively forward to deal with what is a significant impact in our asylum caseload.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
Okay, thank you very much, Director Rodriguez. We really appreciate your being with us.
No, thanks for having me.